This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel here in the studio. We have Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From his home office, a man who's not feeling terrific, but is still soldiering on and providing his reports remotely, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
Thank you very much for joining us today, Jeremiah. And from our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Hi.
We're going to lead off with a story about the British royal family, a devastating situation that the Queen took a firm stance against, but it's just more bad news for what was, until very recently, the throne of David. For this story, we will go to Richard Palmer.
Yes, it's once again been a very bad week for the royal family. It started, we first got news that a U.S. judge had rejected Prince Andrew's attempts to have a court case against him thrown out. So there's an individual that's pursuing Prince Andrew through the U.S. court system. She alleges that Prince Andrew sexually abused her when she was 17, that kind of Jeffrey Epstein prostituted her out to Prince Andrew, basically. Prince Andrew denies these claims, and he was trying to have this case thrown out. The ruling this week means that it doesn't mean that Prince Andrew has been found guilty or anything like that, but it does mean that the court case will go ahead. It will be a court case. It's a civil trial, but I believe it will still be held in front of a jury. So this is pretty terrible news for Prince Andrew. The case would mean that potentially week after week, you'll have these headlines coming out of this court case, just like we saw with the latest one with Ghislaine Maxwell connected to Epstein, with the latest revelations, the latest accusations from witnesses. He has months of terrible publicity to look forward to, and you add to that some of the disastrous publicity he's had already, the interview that he gave that he tried to rescue his reputation and ended up tanking it instead. As a lot of the newspapers have been pointing out this week, he's basically already been found guilty in the court of public opinion. There's speculation that he may decide to settle out of court and just pay the accuser off, which many people would interpret as an admission of guilt, rightly or wrongly. So, that was kind of the opening of the terrible news for the royal family. And then what we heard later, or just last night even, is that in response to that, Prince Andrew has basically been kicked out of the royal family, in effect, is what has happened. It's he had a lot of privileges that come with being part of the royal family, suspended after his TV interview a while ago. He was no longer a working royal, but now he's lost just about everything, and it also seems pretty permanent and irrevocable. It doesn't look like a clear path back. So he's been deprived of his title, his Royal Highness. He's been asked not to use that in an official capacity. And he's been deprived of all of his military duties and all of these things as well. So he'll basically be fighting this court case now going forwards as a private citizen, really, rather than a member of the royal family.
Now, it's hard to overstate just how unusual this is, how severe the punishments against him are. The military has basically said, look, we have to ensure that we represent high standards here. There's this kind of behavior of which he is accused has no part in our organization. The royal family, the Queen, is essentially saying the same thing, that she's trying to mitigate the damage that he's already done to the royal family through what has come out. The remarkable thing is that this is occurring so soon after different circumstances, but a similar type of situation where you had a high profile member of the royal family actually removed from office. Just put it in the context of what else has been happening with Britain's royal family in recent months.
Right. That whole pattern, like you said, is pretty disastrous. You know, you've had Prince Harry and his wife, the Duke and Duchess of Sussex, basically quit the royal family, decide that they're going to up and leave. They're going to go over to the United States. And they've gone on from that to launch all kinds of briefings and accusations against the royal family, accusing an unnamed senior royal of racism, and various explosive accusations, and to vary the metaphor, I guess, plant these seeds that really have taken root afterwards. You know, these accusations of the royal family being racist, these same accusations came up very recently when Barbados abandoned the royal family. You know, they quit. They decided they'd become a republic. They'd no longer have the queen at the head. And their whole kind of statement around that was along the lines of, well, it's a colonialist institution that we need to separate ourselves from. This kind of idea of the royal family being racist is something that kind of is now a regular part of Black Lives Matter type discourse, just fed into this narrative that Britain and America too are institutionally racist. So that's been a tremendously damaging for the royal family. Of course, there's been the death of Prince Philip, who's been a tremendous support for the Queen, and that's been a lot of bad news for her. It's been a hard year for her personally. I think she talked about that even in her Christmas address that she typically gives at the end of the year. You know, a lot of these pieces of bad news. There've been other divorces and things like that as well among more minor royals too.
Yeah. Well, this really takes you back to an article that Gerald Flory wrote in the this is the September 2017 issue, The Fall of the British Royal Family. He made some very strong statements about what we can expect to happen in the royal family in the time ahead. In that article, and pointed to the spiritual reality of what has happened to that family. I want to get into that in a moment. There was also this article that came out today or yesterday about a majority in Australia want to abolish the monarchy. You have this Republican movement that is rising in a lot of the Commonwealth states. And those that have been aligned with Britain and under the rule of the monarch. And of course, the Queen's health has not been the greatest. And there's this sense that she's basically the last thing kind of holding this institution together. It really is on the rocks. Talk about this this spiritual reality behind what we're seeing happen here and why this is so important. A lot of people would maybe look at the trumpet taking an interest in something like this, and it seems maybe out of at odds with what we would normally discuss. But this really is a critical story for us to be talking about.
It is, and if you go back to that 2017 article, you know, Mr. Flory said in there, you know, well, he said that, you know, 2017 was a bad year for the royal family, and here's why it will get much worse. You know, he made some very specific statements about how and why it will get worse. And one big thing that he focused on in that article was family and the example that the royal family was setting in family and morality. And, you know, I don't know whether Prince Andrew is guilty or innocent of these specific accusations, but you can certainly see how him, how his brother have kind of played a leading role really in the relaxation of Britain's family morals. You know, with both of them have being divorced, both of them having these failed marriages. In that article, Mr. Flory said, family is the most sacred of all institutions. Strong families are the backbone of a nation. When families fall apart, nations fall apart. And you can certainly imagine that there'll be all kinds of very embarrassing revelations around this subject potentially continuing to come out in these trials. But another article that it's worth mentioning is one that Mr. Flory wrote on this similar subject just in the latest Trumpet Print edition. in our special issue with that gold cover on the fall of the English-speaking peoples. He has an article in there titled "Threatening the Crown That Binds Britain." And this kind of also answers this question of, you know, well, why are we talking about this? He talks about just the centrality of that institution to the rise of Britain, the rise of the British Empire, the rise of the British Commonwealth. He says in that because biblical morals and a history with God are the source of strength for the throne of David, this throne that they're sitting on, it is the throne of David. In the Bible, David was promised a throne that would last forever. And so, while it's going to last forever, that throne has to be somewhere today. And in his free book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, Mr. Armstrong traces how that is in Britain today. So this unique history means that this throne has been a light to the world and brought great value to the world. And so because of that, it is under attack. The Bible also is very clear about there being an evil spirit being that hates God's plan, that hates anything to do with that plan, and that certainly includes that throne. And so Mr. Flurry in that article says, for this reason, the devil has a special hatred for Britain's royal family. He knows the history and the prophecy of the throne of David contains the very master plan of God. And so what we've seen is a lot of God's protection has been removed from that throne because of the way that they've acted. In that same article, Mr. Flurry says that with their decisions and behavior, the members of Britain's royal family, descendants of David, have led God in rejecting the Bible and in disobeying and disbelieving the God of King David. So there are curses coming upon that throne now, and there's a great warning in that. But in this message, there's also tremendous hope, as God still has a plan for that throne, and he absolutely is using that throne to bring more light into this world than ever before.
Well, if you want more information about this, there is plenty to read on this. I'm putting links together for the show notes for the program. I've got five of them in here with that 2017 article from Gerald Flurry, the one "Threatening the Crown That Binds Britain" from our newest Trumpet, as well as a booklet that Gerald Flurry has written about this very subject, The New Throne of David. That talks about the hope that Richard mentioned there at the end. It is a very important subject, and it truly is stunning to see how those statements that Gerald Flurry made about what would happen to the throne of Britain have come to fruition in a very regrettable and lamentable way. We thank you very much for bringing that to us, Richard. Now for an update on Kazakhstan. Things have simmered down there, but the long-term effects of what has happened really could resonate for some time to come. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, the situation in Kazakhstan seems to have returned to calm this week almost just as rapidly as it exploded into chaos last week. And it's clear that that is because of Vladimir Putin sending his troops in and using force to subdue the uprising. So just to recap a little bit, it was on January 4th that a protest that had started as a small economic demonstration just exploded into violent nationwide protests against the regime that's ruled Kazakhstan for more than 30 years now. So there was just serious discontent with that regime. It was led by Nursultan Nazarbayev, and the people had had all they could stand of the corruption that really defined his leadership. And for a few days there, it really looked like the rage of the people might topple his regime. But that was before Nazarbayev's handpicked successor called on Putin for help. So we spoke last week about how Putin very eagerly responded to this call. Kazakhstan, of course, is one of those former Soviet republics, one of the very important ones, actually, that Putin seeks to bring back under total Russian control. And so he answered that call from President Tokayev by sending in, it was more than 2,000 Russian troops, and they were joined by hundreds more from some other former Soviet countries, all operating under the banner of the Collective Security Treaty Organization. So that's like the Russian version of NATO. But they moved into Kazakhstan rapidly, and by Tuesday of this week, these Russian-led forces had crushed this uprising. So President Tokayev announced that calm had been restored, And he said that the Russians and the other soldiers that came in to help had already started vacating the country and that they would be gone in just a few days. So this is a real testament, I think, to the effectiveness of these Russian forces operating under Putin. They moved in fast, and within just a very short span of time, they suppressed what could have turned into a coup and possibly a democratic turn for Kazakhstan. All of that was stopped, and the same old regime is still in power, this regime that has been just fiercely loyal to Putin for so many years.
So for Russia to quell the violence and then say, okay, that we've done our job, we're going to return home, how much faith do you put in Putin's word on this announcement?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting part of this whole thing. It was not even a week after the Russians arrived that the Kazakh government said, you know, peace has been restored and the Russians and all the other CSTO troops will soon exit the country. So that sounds reasonable. But if you look at several of the other nations where Russia has recently gotten militarily involved, Georgia, Libya, Syria, Ukraine, Azerbaijan, if you look at Russia's lingering presence in all of these places, you see that once Putin puts Russian boots on another nation's ground, he's very likely to keep them there for as long as he finds it useful. And given Kazakhstan's resource wealth, you know, the uranium and the oil, and given its population of ethnic Russians, I believe it's close to a quarter of the country are ethnic Russians, and given the 4,700-mile border that Russia and Kazakhstan share, that's the longest land border between two countries on earth. And given Kazakhstan's Soviet history, you know, when you put all those things together, I think it is likely that Putin's forces may not leave Kazakhstan, or at least not as promptly as the Kazakh government seems to think that they will. And U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken talked about this week. He said, once Russians are in your house, it's sometimes very difficult to get them to leave. And, you know, I think that that's clear from that recent history in Azerbaijan and the other places I mentioned there. So it could well be that Kazakhstan has now become essentially a satellite state to Russia and just considerably more dependent on Putin than even than they had been before.
Well, I guess it will be easy enough to watch the situation and to see what develops there. Just looking at this prophetically, maybe you can just talk about Vladimir Putin's role in end-time prophecy.
Sure, yes. It was back in 2008 that Vladimir Putin invaded his first former Soviet nation. That was the Republic of Georgia. And at that time, Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury wrote, quote, "This was the first military strike of a rising Asian superpower, and there will be more," end quote. And that forecast from Mr. Fleury was based on Bible prophecy. Mr. Fleury was looking at prophecies in Revelation about a massive end-time power block called the Kings of the East. And later, he also focused more on passages in Ezekiel that said that this power would be led by one individual called in Scripture the Prince of Rosh. And time has really proven that Mr. Fleury was right when he said Putin's strike on Georgia was only the start. And he even wrote in his booklet, The Prophesied Prince of Russia, that we should expect Putin to focus especially on former Soviet nations. And since then, we've seen, as I mentioned, those major moves on Ukraine, Belarus, and Azerbaijan, and then in more subtle tactics in other nations as well. And now we have this latest move in Kazakhstan, just getting a Russian military foothold there. So that's just another very important former Soviet nation that we can add to that list. So it all just shows that that forecast back in 2008 was accurate.
Well, if you want more information about that, do check out our booklet from our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, The Prophesied Prince of Russia, that goes into quite a lot of detail about the role of this prophesied leader in the end time. We thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. How are the Iran nuclear talks going? The messaging coming from the White House is not reassuring. For this, we'll turn to Brenton Octagal.
Yeah, the nuclear talks involving Iran and world powers continued into their second week. I think this is the sixth or seventh round. And there's a lot of messaging coming out of the United States that we are getting close to a decision, kind of a breaking point to see whether there will be a new nuclear deal whether the United States will put up more pressure on Iran in some fashion and walk away from the table. And what is interesting about this is that while there hasn't been any type of positive momentum or positive messaging coming out of the talks, the White House spokespeople, be it the State Department or Jen Psaki, the White House spokesperson himself, they've changed the messaging to be really about attacking Donald Trump in a way that both of them came out and gave statements. And Jen Psaki was asked a direct question about just how the talk's going, just a very general question involved from a reporter. And this was her response. She said, "None of the things we're looking at now, Iran's increased capability and capacity, their aggressive actions that they have taken through proxy wars around the world, would be happening if the former president had not recklessly pulled out of the nuclear deal with no thought as to what might come next." So that was her answer to how are the talks going. And then Ned Price over at the State Department, he was asked the same question. This is his response. "It's worth spending just a moment on how we got here. It's deeply unfortunate because of an ill-considered or perhaps unconsidered decision by the previous administration that this administration came into office without these stringent verification monitoring protocols that were in place." And so what it seems like is that, and even there was an Axios report this week that quoted a White House official, that the strategy has changed to sell the nuclear deal, at least get them by. It has been to focus the fire on Trump. Now, they usually do this with all the other issues, COVID, economy, whatever. Mm-hmm. They inherited a bad situation. But now they're really using that same type of strategy with the nuclear deal. And this is a strategic change that they're not going to discuss the contents of the negotiations of, you know, what Iran might get out or whether they're going to go towards a deal or not. But it's just going to be, it's all Trump's fault, whatever happens from this point forward.
So the bottom line seems to be they're ready for the talks to break down. They're preparing themselves for Iran to get a nuclear weapon.
Yeah, it definitely seems that way. And that's what even the Jerusalem Post, who haven't been friendly to Trump at all, and especially this reporter, she had an article that said White House's Trump blame game is a bad sign for the Iran talks. Now, if you are going to have a victory in a negotiation, you claim it's, you know, yeah, it's going very well. This is what we're doing.
Right.
You talk about what you're doing to accomplish that. But if it's going to go bad, you have to go and blame the alternative, the previous administration. So that's what they're doing. So they're probably setting up for one of two things. Either Iran gets the nuclear weapon, they just push the way towards it and they're going to get it, or that the Biden administration is getting ready to reduce sanctions as a way of just containing Iran, or at least putting something on paper to say, we had to do this. We had to restore the former deal with all of its flaws just to try and stop Iran from getting a nuclear weapon, because they were going to get it because of Trump. And so what we would see is that option is Iran is still going to get a nuclear weapon, but at least now they'll have access to a lot of money from the United States. And so these, as the Jerusalem Post brought out, are two very bad options for the world, for Israel in particular, because it bodes that these nuclear talks are not going to result in a less powerful Iran. It's hard to see how it even gets better at all from this point forward.
Yeah, you know, something else about Psaki's remarks that is, and the other official that you spoke of, that's quite remarkable is just how completely unmoored and incorrect and removed from fact their view of what the Donald Trump administration did. There was every reason to pull out of that, and they're still pushing this narrative that the Iran nuclear deal was the only thing that was preventing Iran from getting a nuclear weapon, when the reality is exactly the opposite of that.
Right. So the nuclear deal at its best was an arms control agreement that stopped, or let's say pressured Iran to not get a nuclear weapon until 2030. That was the best part. That was, and leftists would agree with that. It was just a deal to get them flush with, they'll get a lot of money and they can just hold off on their plans. But what's come out, and we even know this from the Obama years, even the years that the deal was negotiated, and even the first year or so that still President Obama, is that Iran was deeply intent on acquiring a nuclear weapon, that they did not give up on their nuclear program. Israeli Mossad agents, when they went into Tehran and took all those documents back in 2018, they proved that. But even this other thing that she said, that if I can quote her again, Iran's increased capability and capacity, their aggressive actions that have taken, that they have taken through proxy wars around the world, wouldn't be happening if President Trump didn't pull out. So President Trump pulled out of the nuclear deal in 2018. And so what she's trying to like push onto people is that Iran was not a belligerent terrorist state
right
until after 2018, and that before that they were good. Now, so what she doesn't include here is the repeated attacks against U.S. servicemen in Iraq that have taken place, the fact that Iran funded and supports a coup, a terrorist takeover of Yemen that happened under Obama's watch. You could talk about Iran firing missiles into Israel, flying drones into Israel under Obama's watch. You could talk about Iran's sponsorship of Hezbollah even before Obama. So to say that Trump is the reason that Iran is stepping up its attacks because his removal from the nuclear deal is just an absolute lie. A bold-faced lie. Surely most people that follow this would know this has been Iran's way even before Obama, but it was only empowered. And I think the Jerusalem Post does a good job at bringing this out, that it was under the nuclear deal negotiated by President Obama, that Iran actually stepped forward its program of taking over the Middle East because they had all the money. They had $150 billion to spend on weapons, on training. And we are seeing the fruits of that. We saw the fruits of that into the Trump presidency. He cut off the funds mm-hmm. for those attacks.
Right.
And really, that's probably the best thing about the nuclear deal, of getting rid of the nuclear deal that the Trump administration did.
Well, it puts Israel in a very difficult position. This entire round of nuclear talks and trying to resurrect this deal, it just shows how isolated Israel is. And anyone hoping to contain Iran's nuclear ambitions has to look at what is happening here with not a lot of optimism. Where would you send people for more information about what to expect from Iran and what the ramifications of the development of its nuclear program are?
Right. I would just get them to read an article I wrote quite recently. It was "Forget Omicron, Iran is 3 weeks away from the bomb."
All right. Thank you very much for that, Brent. We'll link to that in the show notes for the program today. Now to the U.S., where Democrats are pushing hard to ensure they'll be able to control elections far into the future. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, here in the United States, we're less than 10 months away, actually, from the 2022 midterm election. So both Democrats and Republicans are moving into campaign mode. And there was a big development on that front this last Sunday when former First Lady Michelle Obama announced a plan to register 1 million new voters for this midterm election. Now, she's helping run an organization called When We All Vote, and that organization has partnered with 30 other voting organizations, and together their plan is to recruit and train 100,000 volunteers to register at least 10 new Democratic voters each. So that's a lot of new Democrats for the upcoming election if they can pull that off. But and some conservatives may find that concerning, but that's actually the least concerning part about the plan she's put forward, because those 100,000 volunteers, in addition to just looking for other people to try to convince to vote this election, they're also supposed to contact their senators about passing new voting rights and recruit lawyers to protect voting rights. And so you're looking at some pretty substantial legal changes to the voting system if this initiative is successful. This is what Michelle Obama wrote in her bulletin announcing the plan. She said, "We have to vote like the future of our democracy depends on it. We must give Congress no choice but to act decisively to protect the right to vote and to make the ballot box more accessible to everyone. As civic engagement, voting rights, and voter mobilization organizations representing millions of Americans, we are joining together to ensure that Congress acts on voting legislation. And so that statement's really admitting that this initiative is more about changing the voting legislation than it is about just recruiting some new voters. And she gets fairly specific in it, saying basically she wants these groups to, quote, do everything they can to pass the Freedom to Vote Act and the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act, unquote. And so if any of our listeners know anything about those two acts, the Freedom to Vote Act is basically a watered-down version of another act that they failed to pass called the For the People Act. They watered it down slightly so Joe Manchin would vote for it. But still, it would basically give every person in America a federal right to a mail-in ballot. And then the other act, the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act, would basically get the federal government involved in state elections. Basically, any state or local district that has ever discriminated against a minority in the past would have to run their proposed state-level voting legislation before the federal government, before it could actually be approved. So two huge voting reforms that are going to be very controversial for reasons I'll explain in a minute. And you can see how controversial they're going to be because Joe Biden actually, he backed up Michelle Obama's claim on Tuesday. She talked on Sunday. 2 days later, Joe Biden went to Georgia and said that he now supports ending the filibuster in order to pass these acts. With the filibuster, the Republicans could have stonewalled these acts unless all the Democrats and 10 Republicans voted for it. Once you get rid of the filibuster, you don't actually need any Republicans. It's like Joe Manchin's the only one you have to win over. And after that, you can pass it.
It's hard to believe that this whole thing hinges on just a couple of senators, whether this is actually going to take place or not. All of these Democrat efforts push through these voting reforms, textbook Orwellian doublespeak, framing everything in terms of securing democracy, ensuring free and fair elections, and so on, when they're aimed at exactly the opposite.
Right. The 14th Amendment of the Constitution gives every citizen who hasn't committed a felony and is over 18 years old the right to vote. And so these laws, they're not looking about trying to... They give them names like When We All Vote and the Right to Vote and the Fair Vote. Like there's people who should be able to vote who can't. When really what they're about is sending out a mail-in ballot to every citizen in the nation, actually probably every person in the nation, some illegals included.
Right.
And then cracking down on state-level laws that scrutinize those ballots to see if they're real or not.
Mm-hmm.
This is how... Dr. Peter Navarro, he was a former trade advisor for President Trump, authored a three-part report on election fraud in the 2020 election, which is one of the best sourced reports on the election fraud that happened. And he writes that the Democrats used a two-pronged strategy to steal the 2020 election. This is a quote from that report. It says, prong one of the Democrat strategy dramatically increased the amount of absentee and mail-in ballots. Prong two dramatically decreased the scrutiny of such ballots. This resulted in a flood of potentially illegal ballots into battleground states, more than sufficient to tip the scales from a decisive legal victory by President Trump to a narrow and potentially illegitimate alleged victory by Joe Biden. And so he's just bringing out the point that this isn't really about the right to vote. This is about flooding the country with mail-in ballots and then making it illegal to actually scrutinize those ballots to figure out, did they really come from the person they said they came from? Mm. Which is exactly what these two acts, Michelle Obama, are pushing. The Right to Vote Act would make sure that you could send out even more mail-in ballots than they did last election, and a mail-in ballot to every person in the nation. and then that John Lewis Voting Act would really crack down on states that want to see things like voter ID and other things to signature verification, other things to make sure those ballots are legitimate. Now, like I said, Michelle Obama will say, it's like, well, we need this to make sure that like minorities can vote. It's like, well, no, minorities, they're smart enough to get a driver's license and walk to a poll. So it's like they can vote if they want to. This is really about making sure that like illegal immigrants and other people can vote by just finding one of these millions of mail-in ballots floating across the nation, filling it in, sending it in, having it counted, and making it illegal to actually investigate whether it was sent by someone who had the right to vote or not. Yep. And opening the door for all sorts of like dead voters, ghost voters, felon voters, out-of-state voters, non-registered voters, non-citizen voters, unverified absentee ballots, voting machine irregularities, juvenile voters, all these different categories that the Democrats used to rig the 2020 election in kind of like a death by a thousand cuts manner. So it's kind of hard to unriddle exactly how they do it because you don't put all your eggs in one basket.
Right, but all of this is basically aimed at securing those possibilities for securing elections and institutionalizing fraud on the scale of what they did in the 2020 election. Andrea has actually written an article about this, Michelle Obama's Voter Drive. You can check that out at thetrumpet.com. It's right there on the front page right now. We'll link to it in the show notes for the program as well. Thank you, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Bible prophecy talks about watching for wars and rumors of wars while people are saying peace, peace. Well, coming up, we have a few stories looking at military moves and threats from several nations, including Germany, Iran, and Russia. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
Signals are coming out of Germany's new government regarding military policy. To find out what we're learning about this new administration and its ambitions, we will go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, these are some relatively small signals at this stage, but they give up an important indication of the direction of Germany's government. So, first of all, most officially, I guess, Germany has decided to continue its military mission in Iraq. They've extended the authorization to that, or at least put that to Parliament, to October. So they have authorization to have up to 500 soldiers in Iraq. This is part of an even broader mission that has German soldiers stationed in Syria, German soldiers stationed in Jordan, and I think German aircraft in Jordan as well, that's about combating radical Islam in this region. So this new German government is showing they're going to continue with these same policies. We also saw this in Mali, where an important member of a Bundestag committee in Mali, he brought up sending heavier weapons for German forces in Mali. Germany has a huge military presence in Mali. It's around 1,000 soldiers. It's the site of the United Nations' deadliest military mission. And there's real concern within Germany about this mission. Previous German generals have kind of identified Mali as a key base, really, for Germany, a key location where Germany can fight radical Islam that is spreading throughout North Africa, and then also establish a strong presence to then use as a base to push back against radical Islam in other countries. But the mission isn't going particularly smoothly. It is a deadly one. The country is going through a lot of instability. Now even some of the leaders in Mali are expressing dissatisfaction in Germany or disappointment in how well Germany are conducting this mission. Russian contractors, which basically means private militia that with murky ties to the Russian government, becoming increasingly involved in Mali. And so the talk within Germany is that they need to step up, that if they don't kind of change the game, that they risk risk a humiliating retreat from Mali in the same way that the United States was kicked out of Afghanistan. So the most practical and immediate terms of this discussion is sending Boxer armored vehicles into Mali for the troops there. It's relatively lightly armed troops that are there, but certainly a discussion about a much more robust military presence in this region.
Not many people looking at these kinds of military deployments from Germany would find much of concern here. Looking at it from the standpoint of Bible prophecy, it becomes quite a bit more interesting.
Yes, this is, you know, this region-wide effort to confront radical Islam across the Middle East, across North Africa, is something very specifically prophesied in the Bible. We have a reprint article. I think it's been the process or just been updated, Germany's secret strategy to confront Iran, that goes through these prophecies. But it is incredible when you look at some of these Bible verses, how specific these get. There are prophecies that talk about basically Germany forming a ring around Iran and radical Islam. And then you see German generals talking about, well, there's a ring of fire in this area and we need to confront it all around this ring. I mean, the language is almost the same. So it's an incredibly specific example of fulfilled prophecy. And that booklet, Germany's Secret Strategy to Confront Iran, is a great place to go to learn more about that.
All right, fantastic. Thank you very much for that, Richard. Iran is seeking to increase its capability as a naval power. To learn about this, we'll go back to Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, there was a report on January 10th in defensenews.com where it talked about how Iran in 2020 has really stepped up its procurement, or creation, I should say, the construction of naval weapons. It talks about how in 2021 alone, they added a destroyer, four submarines, and 110 combat speedboats to their arsenal. And it goes through this article, which I thought was really good, to show that Iran is realizing, obviously, that it can never take down the big powers in the region, the Gulf states, United States, or Israel, just through traditional means, through having, you know, massive, they don't have an air force, basically. They have this massive missile capability. And then the other arm of their offensive warfare is now increasing their naval capabilities to really try and threaten both international trade and other nations that are acting inside the Strait of Hormuz, Persian Gulf, all the way down through the Red Sea. It quotes in this article an Iranian expert, and this is Mohammad Al-Kaini, and he writes this: Revolutionary Guards Navy is entrusted with combat missions in the Arabian Gulf region in particular, while the regular Navy operates mainly in the Arabian Sea, the Gulf of Oman, and is trying to expand into the Red Sea, which is just really important in terms of biblical prophecy. So they've got these new weapons, boats, these fast attack boats. There are 106 of these brand new things. They're basically a speedboat that have missiles that can be launched from them, machine guns on the front of them. They can drop mines. They can do a lot of different things. And this is one of Iran's ways of getting swarming with a bunch of these, a traditional naval vehicle or a ship of some sort, or even some type of commercial vehicle, and making it very dangerous for these vehicles to be in these waters surrounding Iran all the way to the Red Sea. And so, again, what biblical prophecy talks about is how that Iran is really going to expand its footprint into these waters, pushing around into the Red Sea. We've always known that they've wanted to have the ability to block the Strait of Hormuz, out of which the Persian Gulf enters into the Indian Ocean. A third of seaborne oil goes through this area, and they feel it's very important for them strategically to block that. And they can do that through both their missiles now and their increasing naval presence. And now they want to push, is it even, this man says from, I think he's from Makara University, they want to push their power outside of the Persian Gulf all the way over into the Red Sea. And so that's why they're making more of these more traditional naval vessels.
Well, yeah, talk about this in light of the Bible's prophecies of Iran's role in end time events.
Yeah, I think Warren Reinsch has a great article. It's up on the Trumpet. I think it's right now, or maybe it was yesterday. Can Iran stop international trade through the Red Sea? And it goes through some of these prophecies, how that Mr. Gerald Flurry has talked about Iran being the leader of the King of the South, a prophesied end time alliance of nations, that he has talked about Iran heading that. We know that that alliance from Daniel 11 and verse 40 to 45, a prophecy for our day, is going to be in a relationship with the nations, or at least not, say an alliance with the nations along the coast of the Red Sea as well, on the African coast. And that indicates that Iran really does have a strategic position to maintain or control the waterway, the Red Sea passageway, and everything really from the Persian Gulf around the Arabian Peninsula. Bible prophecy says Iran is going to do that. And so when you see them increasing their naval capabilities, we can see that they're getting the ability to do that as well. So before they have all these ships, they can kind of use their missile presence. They can kind of and fire from land. But I think what we've seen, even in the increase in attacks in the Red Sea from the Houthis, the Iranian-backed Houthis over the past year, over 100 exploding boats were used in the past, I think, couple of years by the Houthis. So they have these remote-controlled exploding boats. They head towards a military vessel of a foreign or of adversary and or a commercial vessel, and they attack it. And as Warren brings out in his article, a lot of shipping companies now are starting to decide whether it's worth their while to risk going through the Red Sea because of the attacks of Iran's navy. And this is something that biblical prophecy says is going to increase all the way to the point that it pushes a far stronger response from European nations to go and deal with this Iranian alliance. And I think people could read Warren's article, Can Iran Stop International Trade Through the Red Sea? They can also read the larger forecast for Iran in Mr. Flurry's book, The King of the South.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that, Brent. Russia has been strong-arming the U.S. and NATO with demands, as we've reported in recent programs. This week, a fresh warning specifically aimed at the United States. For this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, tensions between Russia and the West have been soaring in recent months, mainly because Russian President Vladimir Putin has asserted that he has an exclusive sphere of influence over former Soviet states, and especially Ukraine. As we've discussed several times, Putin has, you know, he's positioned some 100,000 troops near Russia's border with Ukraine. This is a region that Putin has already plunged into a protracted conflict dating back to 2014. It's a conflict that has claimed the lives of more than 13,000 people already. And with this recent buildup, Putin is showing Ukrainians and the whole world, really, that he could wage major invasion at any time unless his claims of exclusive influence are recognized by the other global powers. So Putin's demands are ludicrously unreasonable, but still many people had high hopes for the big meeting that happened this week between officials from NATO and the U.S. and Russia. There were hopes that the various parties would be able to come together and come to some kind of resolution. But yesterday, we learned that those meetings ended basically in stalemate. And in fact, since the meeting failed to bear fruit, and since the Russians feel like their demands and their threats are not really being taken seriously enough, they're now threatening to send military assets to Venezuela and Cuba. So these are nations that are, of course, geographically very near to the U.S. And Russia's deputy foreign minister said Russia can't exclude the possibility of sending significant forces to them if Russia doesn't get its way. So this is it's quite a serious threat. And it seems to be just another indication of just how serious Vladimir Putin is about his demands regarding Ukraine and just how volatile this whole situation has become.
Yeah, the fact that Russia continues to press in addition to the threats that it has been issuing later, it doesn't seem like whatever response Western nations have had to what Russia has done so far is not deterring him whatsoever. But when we talk about a Russian presence in Cuba, a Russian presence right on America's southern border. This really is concerning, not only for the historical reasons that, you know, we almost had a nuclear war over this very issue in a previous generation. Gerald Fleury has talked about the strategic importance of Cuba, and these shipping lanes actually factor into Bible prophecy. Maybe you can just talk about that.
Sure. Yes. And the Russians know very well that when Americans hear about Russian troops in Venezuela, and even more so in Cuba, as you said, that's just alarming for many reasons. Those nations lie near parts of the Caribbean Sea that America relies on a great deal for imports and exports of critical commodities, especially when you think about the Port of Houston and the Port of New Orleans. Those are just integral parts of the U.S. economy, and having Russians or other U.S. adversaries near the lanes that lead to those ports could just really threaten those very important, you know, arteries of American commerce. So this is just profoundly worrying for the United States. And as you said, this does tie into Bible prophecy. There are prophecies in Ezekiel 27 and also Isaiah 23. They talk about a mart of nations, which is really describing an economic alliance that will very soon emerge. And the main players are Russia and China and Japan and several European nations. And when you put those passages alongside Deuteronomy 28:52, it's clear that this mart of nations, its main purpose will be to besiege the U.S. and kind of freeze it out of the global economy. And we do have an article called Storming America's Castle that takes a look at those different Bible passages, and it shows that even though right now some people may be saying, oh, well, this is just bluster from Russia, you know, this isn't an actual threat. In actuality, when this materializes, these prophecies about the besiegement of America, it's going to be just deadly serious for the U.S. So this article zeroes in on Caribbean nations, and it shows how this besiegement of America will be staged largely from there. So it's just a very worrying scenario, and it gets into a great deal of what Trump Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury has talked about with these prophecies.
We sure appreciate you keeping your eye on Vladimir Putin's Russia for us, and we will continue to watch as prophecy develops with that nation. Thank you very much, Jeremiah. A new report on inflation in the United States shows that the dollar is in a lot of trouble. To learn about this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, inflation in America just keeps getting worse and worse, and people both within and without the nation are noticing. On Wednesday, the Bureau of Labor Statistics reported that the Consumer Price Index rose 7% in the 12-month period ending December 31st, a level not seen in almost 40 years. The biggest contributors were gasoline, which was up 56%, car rentals, which were up 36%, hotels up 28%, beef up almost 20%, and furniture up 14%. And so that's definitely bad news for both grocery shoppers who are being squeezed in the produce aisle, and the Biden administration, who polls show that 2/3 of Americans disapprove of how he's handling this crisis. It's also bad news for the U.S. dollar's status as the world reserve currency. The 10-year yield on a treasury bond right now is only 1.4%, so there's not many people eager to buy a treasury bond that's going to give them a 1.4% yield over 10 years when the value of the dollar is being eaten away at 7% per year, which means many analysts are expecting that the Fed is going to have to raise interest rates as early as March in order to get this inflation crisis under control. Now, normally that would be a long, long overdue move. It's they don't let this inflation get this bad. They usually try to keep it below 2%. Now it's all the way up above 7%, and they're only now talking about rising those interest rates. But there is an important reason they've been so reluctant. As you may have heard, our national debt's very close to $30 trillion. We'll pass $30 trillion this year, which means that we actually spent $562 billion just in interest on that debt this year. For comparison, that's about 14% of all tax revenue and about 2/3 of what we spend on our military. Now, we've pointed out at our trumpet before that historians like Niall Ferguson have often warned that empires like the Soviet Union and the Roman Empire and others have collapsed in the past when the cost of servicing its debt exceeds the cost of financing its military. Right now, America's already about 2/3 the way to that point and only has about another $227 billion to go to pass that point. $227 billion sounds like a fair chunk, but it's only 0.8% of $30 trillion, which means that even a 1% increase to the interest rate on our national debt would push America to the point where we're spending more in interest on our debt than on our military. Mm-hmm. And that's normally when you start having to close down overseas military base, let China have the Panama Canal, let Iran have the Straits of Malacca. We can't afford it because we need the money to pay the interest on our debt.
Right.
And it gets in a very dangerous situation. We have an article we can put in the show notes entitled The Dollar's Collapse Has Only Just Begun that points to a prophecy in Micah 5 verses 10 through 12 that shows about America's military power being suddenly cut off, like not a gradual decline, but just like you reach the peak of your power and then it's gone. And then also points to a 1984 coworker letter by Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong predicting that a banking crisis would likely be the catalyst that stripped America of its superpowers and prompted the various nations of Europe to unite into a superpower greater than what the United States is post-financial crisis. And so a lot of different prophecies here about military collapse and the beast power and the rising super state in Europe, but it seems to be all predicated on this huge financial crisis that's almost unavoidable now just because our inflation level is so high and our debt is so high that whatever moves we take to solve the one crisis will exacerbate the other.
Yeah, and you know, it's one thing if this were just kind of the unsavory side effects of misguided policy, but you actually have people in charge of America's economy with intention to destroy the economy, and there are some looking at the situation who say that they've put this nation in this position deliberately. And all they have to do is bump the interest rate and suddenly the whole house of cards falls. We've been warning about it for decades. I'm glad that you brought in those statements from Herbert W. Armstrong from decades ago, showing the prophetic ramifications of what happens globally when this occurs in the United States. We've been watching for it for a long time, and we are right on the precipice. We thank you very much for bringing that to us, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that's it for today's Trumpet Hour. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. Thanks to Parker Campbell for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Thomas Huxley, perhaps the most valuable result of all education is the ability to make yourself do the thing you have to do when it ought to be done, whether you like it or not. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.